Welcome all to the teleclass Disinfection, Sterilization, Current Issues, and New Technologies. On behalf of my colleague, Professor Syed Sattar, let me say how pleased we are that you have joined us today. Now, I'll keep my opening comments brief because, as you can see, there are a lot of slides to work through. At every APIC conference and at just about every SHEA conference and at dozens of conferences around the world every year, you can experience a Rotella lecture. And if he isn't there in person, his published articles will be referenced again and again and again. I can't think of any conference that I've been to where there hasn't been at least one Rotella reference. Dr. Bill Rotella works with the University of North Carolina, and his research on surface decontamination continues to have a very big and very, very global impact, and it's a real honor to have him back with us again for his fifth teleclass lecture. So to give the teleclass, Disinfection and Sterilization, Current Issues and New Technologies, from beautiful Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I am pleased to present my friend, Dr. William Rotella. Bill.
Thank you very much, Paul, and good afternoon to all of you. As Paul mentioned, what we're going to do is review current issues and new technologies. And if you look on my first slide, it summarizes what we have as far as current issues in the area of critical, semi-critical, and non-critical disinfection and sterilization. If you see the topic of critical current issues, what we're going to discuss this afternoon are some issues as it pertains to washer disinfectors, class 6 chemical indicators, flash sterilization, ozone, ethylene oxide, and prions. In the area of semi-critical items, we're going to talk about C. difficile spores, laryngoscopes, new high-level disinfectants, and new automated endoscope reprocessors. And in the area of non-critical items, we're going to talk about some surface disinfection issues. We're going to talk about a new low-level disinfectant, accelerated hydrogen peroxide. We're going to talk about some epidemiologically important pathogens such as norovirus and C. difficile spores. We're going to talk about microfibers used in healthcare. And then we're also going to talk about disinfecting computers and how essentially we can disinfect surfaces that are contaminated with MRSA and whether our recovery of MRSA from surfaces is a product or a practice issue. Now, if you go to the next slide, you'll see a website. This website identifies a website that has a number of slides that may be available to you, as well as some papers on disinfection and sterilization, and certainly the slides from this presentation. The next slide just gives you the Spalding classification scheme. And I think everyone probably is very familiar with the Spalding classification scheme, but that's how we, throughout the world, identify how an object is going to be disinfected. That is, in healthcare, we identify how an object is going to be disinfected depending upon the object's intended use. As you probably already know, there are three categories. The critical category are objects which enter normally sterile tissue or the vascular system or through which blood flows. And of course, anything that is critical has to be sterile. And we'll talk about some sterilization technologies. The semi-critical category are objects that touch mucous membranes or skin that is not intact, and they require a disinfection process that we refer to as high-level disinfection. And that kills all microorganisms with the exception of high numbers of bacterial spores. And the third category are non-critical items. And there are objects that touch only intact skin, and they require low-level disinfection, or really sometimes only a non-germicidal detergent. So we'll talk about current issues and new technologies that are in the critical category, the semi-critical category, and the non-critical category. Now, before beginning, let me mention the next slide, which says that the new CDC guideline should be published sometime this summer. I was actually in contact with them just a couple of days ago, and I expect it to be available sometime this summer, although the precise date is unknown. Of course, this new CDC guideline is the first guideline on disinfection and sterilization since 1985. This guideline has approximately 300 pages with 20 pages of recommendations and over 1,100 references, and of course, it is evidence-based. Now, the next slide just shows you some surgical instruments and some materials used in surgery, and of course, these are all critical objects. Of course, in the following slide, you can see some critical objects, and of course, we know that critical objects have to be sterile, and they would include things that have contact with sterile tissue, such as surgical instruments, cardiac catheters, and implants. The following slide tells us some of the sterilization technologies that we have available to us throughout the world. Probably the first four are the most commonly used throughout the world. You can see steam sterilization, hydrogen peroxide gas plasma, ethylene oxide, and peracetic acid, which is a chemical sterilization process, and then some newer technology, which of course is ozone, and then some technology that is used in many Western European countries to include steam formaldehyde. As mentioned, probably the first four are the most common. The next slide just shows you an endoscope. Of course, an endoscope is an example of a semi-critical item requiring high-level disinfection. But if you look at the following slide, you can see other semi-critical items. Other semi-critical items, of course, would have contact with mucous membranes. And they would include respiratory therapy equipment, anesthesia equipment, endocavitary probes, thermometers, and diaphragm fitting rings. Of course, all these objects would have contact with mucous membranes. If you look at the following slide, you can see essentially the high-level disinfectants that can be used on semi-critical items. Now, these are the only high-level disinfectants that can be used in the United States. That is, in the United States, the FDA clears the high-level disinfectants or chemical sterilants that we can use for high-level disinfection of a semi-critical item. And of course, you see many germicides listed there. Again, they are all high-level disinfectants that are cleared by the FDA. Now, you can see that the first two there are probably the two most commonly used, the glutaraldehyde and the ortho-thaldehyde. Some of the other products listed there have excellent antimicrobial activity, such as hydrogen peroxide at high concentration of 7.5%, or hydrogen peroxide and peracetic acid, as well as chlorine or a high concentration of free chlorine. But these products, of course, as demonstrated by the asterisk, may cause some cosmetic and functional damage. So they're not commonly used, at least for some items such as an endoscope that may be sensitive or the functionality of the endoscope may be altered by the use of some of these oxidizing agents. The next slide just reminds us that for some equipment we could use pasteurization, that is some semi-critical items such as respiratory therapy equipment as well as anesthesia tubing, and pasteurization of course is just higher temperatures at a time of approximately 30 minutes. And of course that's immersion in water that is approximately 170 degrees or 165 degrees Fahrenheit. The next slide just shows a patient room, and of course that introduces the concept of low-level disinfection for non-critical objects. The following slide lists some of the low-level disinfectants that we commonly use for non-critical objects, and that would include things like ethyl or isopropyl alcohol, chlorine, phenol, iodophores, and quaternary ammonium compounds. The germicide concentrations are listed, and you see an exposure time of at least 1 minute. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, but the minimum exposure time is 1 minute. That's what the CDC guideline will say. Of course, it takes typically about a minute and a half for a surface to dry after a surface is wetted by a cloth. So if you wanted to have a longer exposure time, such as 10 minutes, you would normally have to reapply that germicide to have a longer exposure time. So typically, most of us in healthcare have a germicide contact time or exposure time of about a minute to 2 minutes, which is a typical dry time. And the CDC guideline will make that as a recommendation. Now let's start talking about some of these current issues and new technologies. And let's first look at critical items and sterilization. And you can see if you go to the following slide, some of the items we're going to talk about, which we've already alluded to. We're going to talk a little bit about cleaning with washer disinfectors and how effective they are. We're going to talk a little bit about monitoring sterilization with Class 6 chemical indicators. We're going to say a few words about flash sterilization, ozone, ethylene oxide, and prions. So let's begin by looking at a slide that's entitled Cleaning. And the only point of this slide is, of course, to mention to you that there are many ways that we achieve cleaning in our healthcare facilities. We can achieve cleaning by a mechanical method, such as washer disinfectors, which most of us use, or we can achieve cleaning by manual method. Of course, the mechanical methods are automated equipment that, of course, typically increase productivity, improve cleaning effectiveness, and decrease worker exposure. Now, the cleaning effectiveness is what we're going to talk about. The next slide will just show you a typical washer disinfector. This is a washer disinfector that's at UNC Healthcare, where I am located. And, of course, this is in central processing, and we actually have two washer disinfectors like this. Now, this washer disinfector is probably very similar to what you might have, although you may have a one-chamber washer disinfector that does much the same thing as this five-chamber washer disinfector. The next slide will try to describe to you the five chambers in the washer disinfector. And as you look at those five chambers, you see terms such as a pre-wash, where there is a use of enzymatics over the load for a period of time. And then there's a wash, where there is a detergent wash solution at 150 degrees Fahrenheit, which is sprayed over the load for 4 minutes. And then there's an ultrasonic cleaning, followed by a thermal and lubricant rinse, again with hot water, this time 180 degrees Fahrenheit, and then there's a drying. And the drying involves hot air for a period of typically about 4 minutes. So there's very high temperature wash, very high pressure sprays, and very high temperature drying. And the question is, how good are these washer disinfectors in removing microorganisms? Well, if you look at the next slide, we inoculated with a very high level of epidemiologically important microorganisms, a number of surgical instruments at our facility just to try to determine how effective these washer disinfectors are. And the following slide will give you some example of the effectiveness. You should be looking at a slide that says washer disinfector, removal slash inactivation of the inoculum of instruments. Now, I'm showing you the exposed data, that is, the inoculum was exposed. It wasn't hidden. But we actually have also some unexposed data, which are very similar. Now, if you look at the organisms, you can see a number of organisms were tested, to include MRSA, VRE, Pseudomonas, mycobacteria, and, of course, some spores. That's Geobacillus stereothermophilus spores, which is the spore we use for monitoring the efficacy of steam sterilizers. The next column shows you the inoculum. And of course, 10 to the 7th is greater than 10 million. That is 2.6 times 10 to the 7th is 26 million cells. So that's how many cells of MRSA we put on the surgical instrument. And the next column, you can see the log reduction. And of course, what it complete means is there's complete log reduction. This process was able to completely remove or inactivate the 26 million MRSA that were placed on the surgical instrument. So there were zero positives out of 8 replicates in this particular experimental series. And if you go down those log reduction columns and the number of positives, you'll see how very effective the washer disinfectors are. So that's the only point of this particular segment. Washer disinfectors are extremely effective, which of course is stated in the following slide. They're very effective in removing and inactivating microorganisms from instruments. Now the next slide shows some surgical instruments with a chemical indicator. And the point that I want to make here is the issue of class 6 emulating indicators and whether or whether not they are a substitute for a biological indicator. In the CDC guideline that I alluded to, the CDC guideline will say to use a biological indicator to monitor the effectiveness of sterilizers at least weekly with spores intended for that type of sterilizer. Now, of course, you can use spores more frequently than weekly. In fact, in our central processing area, we use spores more weekly, certainly more than weekly, certainly for monitoring our steam sterilizers. But the point that I wanted to make is that class 6 emulating indicators are not a substitute for biological indicators. Let me repeat that. Class 6 emulating indicators are not a substitute for biological indicators. If you look at the next slide, I just have a list of the chemical indicators, and we don't have time now to go through all the chemical indicators. But if you look at the following slide, you'll see some description of class 6 emulating indicators. And I want to mention to you that there is no professional organization, that is ARN or AMI or any professional organization, there is no professional organization that has recommended the use of class 6 emulating indicators as a substitute for biological indicators, and there are no data that demonstrate that the class 6 emulating indicator mimics a biological indicator at suboptimal sterilization times. So whereas these indicators are supposed to emulate or mimic the behavior of a biological indicator, there are no data that demonstrate that it mimics a biological indicator at suboptimal sterilization time. The next thing I wanted to mention as it pertains again to this issue of critical items is the issue of flash sterilization. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with flash sterilization and the fact that flash sterilized items are used for, or flash sterilization, more correctly, are used for items that must be used immediately. Something, a surgical instrument that drops to the floor, something like that would be an example of a need for flash sterilization. And of course, the guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and ARN states that you do not use flash sterilization for reasons of convenience, as an alternative to purchasing additional instrument sets, or to save time. Now, I wanted to mention to you, and you'll see in the following slide, that if you look back at the history of flash sterilization, there's two important dates. The first date is 1942. Actually, it was Underwood that first defined flash sterilization as 3 minutes at 250 degrees Fahrenheit for instruments when there is an extreme emergency, which was not defined. In 1969, John Perkins redefined flash sterilization of an unwrapped item to the current definition of 270 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 minutes in a gravity sterilizer. Well, you may be wondering why I'm mentioning this. I'm mentioning it because flash sterilization principles, as defined by Underwood and Perkins and perpetuated by professional organizations, are no longer applicable because as the longstanding concerns associated with flash sterilization have changed over the past 40 years. If you have a slide in front of you that says flash sterilization, I've listed the historical concerns associated with flash sterilization. When I first began in infection control approximately 30 years ago, what we were told was the reason that flash sterilization was suboptimal were really three issues. One issue is a lack of a timely biological indicator to monitor the performance. Now, at the time, there wasn't a timely biological indicator, but now, as you probably know, we have rapid readout biological indicators that allow monitoring within 1 hour. The second issue is the possibility for contamination of process items during transportation to the operating room. That is, you had to transport the exposed instruments from the point of sterilization to the point of use in the OR. But of course, many of you know that now we have containers that ensure aseptic and sterile delivery to the OR. And the third issue is sterilization cycle parameters were suboptimal. Now, of course, we've extended our exposure times and temperatures, so that doesn't appear to be true any longer. And I think while all of you recognize that there should be no compromise with patient safety, the prohibitions and the principles regarding flash sterilization should be reassessed by professional organizations. And I believe that will be happening. So I think there is going to be some changes in the future regarding flash sterilization. But what do we do now? Well, right now, we as well as you should comply with the current recommendations. But I think that in time, there may be some modifications. So that's the point of flash sterilization. Ozone, of course, ozone is a sterilization technology that is FDA cleared. It is used for metal and plastic surgical instruments, including some instruments with lumens. Now, of course, with any new technologies, there are always limitations. One of the limitations associated with ozone is we have very little data. That is, we have little data in a clinical setting or in a research setting regarding things such as material compatibility, penetrability, and organic material resistance. That is ozone effective in the presence of organic matter? And of course, we also have relatively limited comparative microbiocidal efficacy data. I would like to see, as I always like to see, comparative data between ozone and other low-temperature and high-temperature technologies to determine the relative effectiveness of one technology versus another, and those data are not yet available. But ozone is an FDA-cleared sterilization process. The next slide, you're going to see a number of sterilizers, and that's actually sterilizers at UNC Healthcare, to include some ethylene oxide sterilizers in the foreground. And the reason that I wanted to make mention of ethylene oxide is that in the United States, there is going to be a change that we will have to comply with beginning in December 2008. That is, the EPA wants to reduce the amount of ethylene oxide, and they believe that there should be a regulation that requires essentially that we run full loads in our ethylene oxide sterilizer. So we have to make sure that we run full loads in our ethylene oxide sterilizer. Now, how about if it's medically necessary to run a partial load? Well, the EPA has accommodated that by saying, of course, you can run partial sterilizer loads if it's medically necessary to do so. And that's left to the discretion of the hospital. So we have to keep records. We have to document every sterilizer load. And when the loads aren't full, we have to note the medical reason and who authorized that partial sterilizer load be run. And it's not going to be complicated, I don't believe, because an employee or a staff member in central processing can make that determination, administration can make that determination, an MD can make that determination. Essentially, all we need to do is document when we have partial sterilizer loads that it was medically necessary, and that's, again, left to the discretion of the hospital. Now, the next slide talks a little bit about Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, and we're going to say a few words about CJD. And if you go to the next slide, you should have a slide that says prion diseases at the top. And, of course, a prion disease is a disease that is caused by a prion, which is a proteinaceous infectious agent. It has no nucleic acid. It has no DNA and RNA. It is a host protein that converts to a pathologic isoform that accumulates in the neural cells and it eventually causes death within a very brief period of time of symptoms appearance, generally within 6 months to a year. Now, why are we talking about prions? We're talking about prions because, of course, they're resistant to conventional disinfection and sterilization methods. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a slide that talks about or reviews the decreasing order of resistance of microorganisms to disinfectants and sterilants. And you can see that prions are at the very top. They are the most resistant to disinfectant and sterilization processes. The next slide will just mention to you that the reason we're concerned about this is if we look at the literature, you'll find a few examples of medical or surgical instruments involved disease transmission of prions. The two most noteworthy cases are the cases involving brain electrodes in the brain. They are irrefutable cases of prion transmission. The other cases involving neurosurgical instruments in the brain, they're more controversial, but certainly there's some data to suggest that those neurosurgical instruments may have been involved in disease transmission of CJD. Now, the next slide will essentially tell us why we're talking about this. What we want to do is prevent essentially the secondary spread through contaminated surgical instruments. And if you look at the following slide, you'll see the recommendations that are in the ARN guideline, recommendations that are in the AIMI guideline regarding the treatment of instruments that have contact with high-risk tissue. Now, if you look at the first bullet, what that says is if you have a critical or a semi-critical item, and that device, that item, that instrument is contaminated with high-risk tissue, and high-risk tissue is brain, spinal cord, and eyes, from a high-risk patient, and a high-risk patient would be a person suspected or known to be infected with CJD, that instrument requires special prion reprocessing. You do not do it the way you normally do it. It requires special prion reprocessing. And the way that we conduct special prion reprocessing is shown. You can either use sodium hydroxide in steam sterilization, or you can use what we use, which is 134 degrees centigrade, higher than the normal temperature for steam, which is 132. So it's a higher temperature, 134, for 18 minutes. Now, the next slide just gives you an idea of what we mean by high-risk patient, high-risk tissue, and high-risk medical device. So that gives you further explanation of when you would have to do the special prion reprocessing. The next slide gives you some recent data. And the point that I wanted to make now is that there are recent data which demonstrates that maybe in the near future we can modify our current way for sterilizing instruments that are contaminated with prions involving high-risk tissue. The point being, there's new technology that we may be able to integrate into our practices, and with these new technologies, we may be able to eliminate special prion reprocessing. And that's mentioned in another slide that is entitled Prion Disease Transmission, Can We Apply Standard Precautions to Prevent Risk? So right now, we have to do what the next slide shows, and that is for instruments that are contaminated with high-risk tissue from a high-risk patient, they require special prion reprocessing. But someday, hopefully in the near future, there will be some new technologies that may alter the need for special prion reprocessing in the future. And what I'm talking about are new low-temperature technologies that may be effective, such as vaporized hydrogen peroxide. I'm talking about the use and the integration of alkaline detergents into our washer disinfectors that may result in a significant log reduction during our cleaning procedure prior to sterilization. Again, these technologies are not yet integrated into practice, but hopefully in the near future they will, and that may alter the issue of special prion reprocessing. Now we're going to skip to semi-critical items, which you should see on the slide, and we're going to talk about C. difficile spores, laryngoscopes, new automated endoscope reprocessing, and new high-level disinfectants. You should have a slide that says C. difficile spores. If you have that, skip to the next slide, because the next slide will give you some data. One question that I'm commonly asked is, will the commonly used high-level disinfectants, such as Cydex and Cydex OPA and Steris, which is parasitic acid, will those products kill the C. difficile spores at concentrations that would likely be present on an endoscope that was used on a patient that was colonized or infected with C. difficile? And the answer is yes. This slide shows that there is a four-log reduction of several different strains of C. difficile spores by the three most commonly used high-level disinfectants / chemical sterilants. Again, glutaraldehyde, ortho-thialdehyde, and parasitic acid. The next slide, you'll see essentially a endoscope. And the issue here is, I wanted to mention to you that we have, of course, endoscope reprocessing, and endoscopes are very difficult to effectively reprocess. And of course, we have the narrowest margin of safety associated with our reprocessing of semi-critical items. Now, hopefully you have a slide that's entitled Semi-Critical Equipment, which is follow the endoscope slide. And if you have that slide, you'll see a statement that the narrow margin of safety associated with reprocessing endoscopes is attributed to the high microbial load and the complex medical instruments such as endoscopes, which of course have long, narrow lumens. So our issue here is, how do we essentially prevent transmission associated with endoscopes? Endoscopes, of course, have the most cases of disease transmission associated with them, again, because there's this narrow margin of safety because the instrument is so complex and the instrument has such a high microbial load. And of course, as you know, there have been errors in designing and reprocessing these semi-critical items, that is, endoscopes. These errors continue, and these errors continue to place patients at risk of infection. Now, if you go another slide, you'll see essentially a slide that's entitled Automatic Endoscope Reprocessors. And of course, the reason we're going to talk about automated endoscope reprocessors is there are a couple new automated endoscope reprocessors, and the reason we like automated endoscope reprocessors is they automate and standardize reprocessing steps. Not that they're without problems. There can always be failures associated with automated endoscope reprocessors, and even they have been linked to outbreaks. But in general, we like the fact that these automated endoscope reprocessors automate and standardize the reprocessing steps. Now, if you go to the next slide, you'll see an automated endoscope reprocessor called Evotec. And Evotec is an automated endoscope reprocessor that actually has an FDA-cleared cleaning claim, and we'll talk about that in a second. The next automated endoscope reprocessor we have is an endoscope reprocessor that is called Reliance. And in the following slide, we have a few statements about these automated endoscope reprocessors. And the point that I wanted to make is that these new technologies appear to be very good at removing soil and removing microorganisms, and they are at least comparable or equivalent to that achieved by optimal manual cleaning. So there are studies in the literature which demonstrate that these technologies are effective in effectively removing soil and microorganisms, and that effectiveness is at least equivalent to that achieved by optimal manual cleaning. Now, I mentioned to you a moment ago that the new Evitec integrates cleaning. That is, it has an FDA-cleared cleaning claim, which means that after it has been pre-cleaned in the processing room, that is, in the endoscope procedure room, when it's taken to the reprocessing room, it doesn't have to be re-cleaned. It doesn't have to be cleaned with brushes and rags. It can be placed immediately into the automated endoscope reprocessor because data has been presented to the FDA, which demonstrates that for this particular unit, the soil and microbial removal accomplished by the unit during the cleaning phase is equivalent to that achieved by optimal manual cleaning. So the Evitec has an integrated cleaning claim. Both of these products have excellent capability of removing soil and microbial contamination equivalent to that achieved by optimal manual cleaning. Now, the next slide, you should have a laryngoscope. And the laryngoscope should be in two pieces. Of course, we have the blade and we have the handle. Probably many of you realize that blades have been linked to healthcare-associated infections. Handles have not. Many of you realize that many hospitals consider the blade as semi-critical, and they high-level disinfect the blade, and they consider the handle as non-critical, and they low-level disinfect the handle. Now, you should have a slide that's entitled Reprocessing of Rigid Laryngoscopes. And the only point that I would like to make with this is that essentially it would be ideal if we could high-level disinfect or sterilize both the blade and the handle. That is, there is a possibility, of course, of contamination of the handle. Although the handle has not been directly linked to healthcare-associated infections, it certainly can be contaminated with blood and other potentially infectious material, and that potential for contamination and the fact that the blade and the handle are used together would suggest that they possibly or ideally be high-level disinfected or sterilized. We, for many years, would only high-level disinfect the blade, and we would low-level disinfect the handle. More recently, we are minimally high-level disinfecting both the blade and the handle. So the recommendation we're talking about is to clean, then either high-level disinfect or sterilize the blades and the handles, which is probably a little bit different than many of you are doing. The next point is hydrogen peroxide, liquid-based high-level disinfectant. There's going to be a new product available in the United States sometime in the future. It's available in Canada, which is a hydrogen peroxide, liquid-based high-level disinfectant. The next slide will just give you some description of that product. It's called Recert. It's a high-level disinfectant involving 2% hydrogen peroxide. It has a claim of 5 to 8 minutes at 20 degrees centigrade. You can see that it is odorless, non-staining, and ready to use, and has a 12-month shelf life and a 14-day reuse life. The next slide talks a little bit about it actually shows a endocavitary probe, a vaginal probe, and we're going to talk a little bit about the endocavitary probe covers and what we have to do when we disinfect any endocavitary probe. Now, many of you are probably using endocavitary probe covers, and of course, you probably think that that probe cover protects the probe from contamination by the microflora of the patient. But actually, there are data that suggest that those probe covers have frequent perforation rates. That is, whether it is a condom or a sheath or a probe cover, the perforation rate, either before use or after use, seems to be quite high. It varies anywhere from 1% to 2% to 25% to 65% to 81%. So the bottom line is that we cannot depend on these probe covers to provide protection of the probes from microbial contaminants of the patient. So the CDC recommendation, which you'll see on the following slide, will say that if you have an endocavitary probe, such as a vaginal or rectal probe, and of course that probe is going to have contact with mucous membranes, the item is then considered semi-critical, and the guideline will say that you cannot downgrade the level of disinfection. That is, you, because of the use of that cover or that condom, you cannot say that the instrument is not going to become contaminated. Therefore, you can do a low-level disinfection. The guideline is going to say, because those probe covers do not maintain their integrity, you have to realize that the probe is becoming contaminated and you have to high-level disinfect that probe. So high-level disinfection of probes is going to be recommended regardless of the use of probe covers, condoms, and sheaths. The next item is the non-critical items, the low-level disinfection items. We have several things we're going to talk about here, to include a new low-level disinfectant, accelerated hydrogen peroxide. We're going to talk about how to disinfect surfaces that are contaminated with norovirus or C. difficile spores. We're going to talk a little bit about microfiber. We're going to talk about disinfecting computers and touch screens. And we're going to talk about why we have microorganisms remaining on surfaces after environmental surfaces has performed surface disinfection. So let's begin with essentially a slide that just shows you a patient room, followed by a slide that shows you low-level disinfection for non-critical objects. And again, we see the germicides that are used and the exposure time of at least 1 minute. The germicides, again, are things like ethyl or isopropyl alcohol, chlorine, phenolics, iodophore, and quaternary ammonium compounds. Now, as I mentioned, there is going to be a new product introduced into the United States that has been available in Canada. It's an accelerated hydrogen peroxide product. It now has been EPA registered as a ready-to-use product and as a wet wipe. It has a one-minute bactericidal claim, and you should be looking at a slide that essentially shows this product. It shows essentially accelerated hydrogen peroxide-based surface disinfectant. The only disadvantage that I can see in reviewing the literature to date is essentially the cost. That is, the ready-to-use cost is about $5.80 per pint compared to a quaternary ammonium compound, which is about $3.21 per pint in a ready-to-use form. The next slide mentions C. difficile, and we're going to talk about C. difficile as it pertains to surfaces. Remember, we said that the high-level disinfectants are effective. Now, what are we going to do with the surfaces? So we should have a slide that says C. difficile spores, and the next slide will tell you a little bit about environmental contamination and how much environmental contamination occurs in the area of a patient that is colonized or infected with C. difficile. Well, you should have a slide that says environmental contamination, C. difficile, and you should see some numbers such as 25%, 31%, 29%, and so forth. And what those numbers represent is essentially the frequency of contamination in the vicinity of a patient that is colonized or infected with C. difficile. For example, the fourth bullet down, 29% of the environmental surfaces were positive for C. difficile. So what that's telling us is the frequency of contamination in the area of a patient that is occupied, for example, by an asymptomatic patient with C. difficile. If you actually look at a patient that is infected with C. difficile and demonstrates C. difficile-associated diarrhea, actually the frequency of contamination, at least in one study, is even higher, and in one study it was shown to be 49%. So the point is there's significant contamination of environmental services in the area of a patient colonized or infected with C. difficile. The next slide just tells us something that I think we would intuitively know, and that is when the environment's contaminated, hands will become contaminated. If you look at the first bullet, you'll see the statement that the presence of C. difficile on the hands correlated with the density of environmental contamination. You can see that greater than 50% environmental sites positive, 36% hand cultures positive. What does that mean? That means that when you have a very high level of C. difficile in the environment, you're going to have a higher frequency of hand contamination. Now, that shouldn't be surprising to us. When there's a high level of contamination of environmental surfaces, the healthcare workers will touch those surfaces and will contaminate their hands, and that's all that's telling us. So the higher the level of environmental contamination, the higher the frequency of hand contamination, and then, of course, the higher frequency of hand contamination can result in transmission to patients that are neither colonized nor infected with C. difficile. The next slide talks a little bit about Clorox. We've already mentioned that products such as OPA, glutaraldehyde, and parasitic acid are effective against the C. difficile spores. This slide tells us that other products can be effective, such as high concentrations of sodium hypochlorite. You can see in this slide that we get a 4-log reduction within 10 minutes using 6,000 parts per million of chlorine. And the next bullet actually shows that with 1,900 parts per million of chlorine, we also see an effective inactivation of C. difficile spores. So at concentrations from roughly 2,000 parts per million to 6,000 parts per million, we get effective inactivation of the C. difficile spores. Now, I should mention that most people do use a 1 to 10 concentration of sodium hypochlorite that you would buy at the grocery store, or bleach that you would buy at the grocery store. When you buy it at the grocery store, it typically contains roughly 6% sodium hypochlorite. That means it contains 60,000 parts per million of chlorine. When you dilute that 60,000 parts per million of chlorine by a dilution of 1 to 10, that will give you 6,000 parts per million of chlorine, and that's how it's typically used when it is used in healthcare to prevent transmission of C. difficile in an endemic, a hyperendemic or epidemic setting. The next slide just shows you all the products that are not effective against C. difficile spores. Even at 20-minute exposure times, you can see products such as CHG, Vespene, isopropyl alcohol, ethanol, hydrogen peroxide. All of those products are not effective even at 20 minutes in killing C. difficile spores. There was no measurable activity. The next slide really is the recommendation. The recommendation that is in the CDC guideline on environmental infection control, the recommendation that is going to be in the CDC guideline on disinfection and sterilization. And what it says in the second bullet is in units with high endemic C. difficile infection rates or in an outbreak setting, to use dilute solution of sodium hypochlorite. We just mentioned that we should make a 1 to 10 dilution of bleach for essentially routine disinfection when you have high endemic C. difficile infection rates or in an epidemic or outbreak setting. We do not use essentially 1 to 10 dilution of bleach when we have sporadic cases of C. difficile in our hospital. We only use it if we have concerns about the environment being involved in the disease transmission, and that would be in situations where we think we have cross-transmission or high endemic C. difficile infection or an outbreak setting. Now, I should mention also that that's a Category 2 recommendation to use essentially this 1-10 dilution of bleach in hyperendemic and epidemic situations. Now, norovirus, the reason we're talking about norovirus, and you'll see a couple of norovirus slides, you should have before you a slide that has a number of different viruses, pictures of a number of different viruses. One of them is norovirus on the lower right-hand corner. Norovirus is a single-stranded RNA virus, and we'll see some statements about norovirus on the following slide. We can see that, of course, noroviruses cause gastroenteritis in humans. You know about norovirus primarily because of its cause of gastroenteritis on ships, that is, cruise ships, gastroenteritis. Norovirus is unusual in that it has a very low infective dose, as few as 10 to 100 particles. But norovirus has not only been restricted to cruise ships, but it also has been causing epidemics in hospitals. In fact, in the last several years, we've had two such epidemics at UNC. In both situations, we had to restrict admission of patients to the area that the epidemic was present in. So it can cause significant control issues in hospitals, and as I mentioned, there's increased frequency of norovirus in hospitals. Now, the next slide just gives you some information about environmental contamination. Like C. difficile, norovirus can contaminate the environment, and norovirus can remain present in the environment for periods of time, 20, 22 days. Not as long as C. difficile spores. C. difficile spores can actually remain in the environment for as long as 5 months. A norovirus can remain in the environment on environmental surfaces for up to 20 to 22 days. Excuse me. So this particular slide that we're looking at environmental contamination. We can see essentially the presence of norovirus as identified by a PCR technology, a polymerase chain reaction technology. We can see it present in hospitals, hotels, rehabilitation centers, and long-term care facilities. As I mentioned to you and shown on the next slide, you can see some data on environmental survival. Norovirus can survive, as I mentioned, as long as 20 days in various conditions. You can see the one slide talks about, or the one bullet talks about 20 degrees centigrade with a 9-log reduction of the feline Khaleesi virus between 21 and 28 days in a dried state. The next slide just talks about the role of the environment, and without going into a lot of detail, this particular virus is thought to have an environmental mode of transmission. The next slide just tells us that products that we commonly use for low-level disinfection, such as quaternary ammonium compounds, may not be effective against the norovirus. Here we see some data with a surrogate for the norovirus using a feline Khaleesi virus. And if you look at the slide, you'll see that a quaternary ammonium compound was not effective at 1 minute. An ethanol just had marginal effectiveness at 1 minute, showing a 1.25 log reduction. The next slide just tells us not only do we have data that are inactivation data demonstrating that norovirus may be relatively resistant to products such as quaternary ammonium compounds, we also have some epidemiological data. The epidemiological data that are shown on this slide talk about a school outbreak of norovirus when they were cleaning with a quat, that had no impact on the course of the outbreak, but the outbreak did stop after the school closed for 4 days and was cleaned using a chlorine-based agent. Similarly, the following bullet has the same kind of data where the detergent-based cleaning was not effective to eliminate norovirus contamination, but when they used a hyperchlorate formulation, containing 5,000 parts per million of chlorine, it was sufficient to decontaminate surfaces. So the point is that due to the relative resistance of both the C. difficile spores and norovirus during clusters of these particular agents, surfaces should be disinfected with a product that is shown to be effective. And one product that is shown to be effective for both of these agents is a 1 to 10 dilution of bleach containing 5,000 parts per million of chlorine. Now, the next slide just makes the point that there are other technologies that are new that could possibly be equally effective and maybe even more effective. The slide talks about vaporized hydrogen peroxide. And without going into a lot of detail because of time, this hydrogen peroxide vapor, it was ejected into a room, and it was found to be very effective in eliminating the C. difficile spores. When this particular product was used, C. difficile was not isolated from any of 155 cultures that were obtained after the hydrogen peroxide vapor treatment. Now, I should also mention that the hydrogen peroxide vapor was also found to be effective for multiply drug-resistant organisms. That is, there are other studies that show this, including MRSA, VRE, and multiply drug-resistant gram-negative rods. So there are some data demonstrating effectiveness with hydrogen peroxide vapor on C. difficile spores. Now, next we're going to talk about microfiber. So if you go a couple of slides, you'll see a slide that is talking about microfiber cleaning. And very briefly, we're going to talk about microfiber cleaning. Of course, microfiber we use them as pads typically for floor cleaning or rags for elevated horizontal surface cleaning. Microfibers are a combination of polyester and polyamide, and they provide a cleaning surface that is about 40 times greater than conventional string mops. So the microfiber pad would contain significantly more cleaning surface than the conventional cotton string mop. Now, if you've used microfiber pads, you'll also know that they're much lighter than a cotton string mop, which has, of course, ergonomic advantages. And you'll also probably realize that they possibly will reduce the chemical use and chemical disposal, as also reduce the cleaning times. Well, the thing that we were interested in is, does the microfiber provide the same or better removal of microorganisms on surfaces? So we use these microfiber pads, which are shown in the slide, and I'm going to discuss with you is a study that was done which showed that essentially the microfiber was as effective, if not more effective, than the disinfectant with a cotton string mop. Without going into a lot of detail, let's go to a slide that's entitled Effectiveness of Microfiber Mops. This was a study that was published in 2007. You can see that in this study, we compared various methods for floor cleaning. The two that I'm going to concentrate on are the disinfectant regular mop. So it's a cotton string mop using a disinfectant. You can see 95% removal or an activation. And then if you go down a few lines, you'll see detergent regular mop. You'll see 68%. So if you used a regular mop with the detergent, you got significantly less inactivation removal of microorganisms. But the following row uses detergent microfiber system. And the detergent microfiber system was equivalent to the disinfectant regular mop. So there's something about microfiber that grabs or attracts microorganisms and dirt that makes it equivalent to the removal or inactivation that you get with a disinfectant employing a regular cotton mop. So that's the point there. Microfiber system demonstrates superior microbial removal compared to cotton string mops when used with a detergent cleaner. And that's a statement that is made on the following slide in the form of a summary. I should also mention that the use of a disinfectant did not improve the microfiber elimination demonstrated by the microfiber system. But the use of a disinfectant did significantly improve microbial removal when a cotton string mop was used. The following slide looks at computer keyboards. And because of time, I'm just going to make a couple comments regarding computer keyboards. I'm going to mention that we were interested in this to determine if we could use different disinfectants on our keyboards and how effective they would be, and whether these disinfectants would cause any cosmetic or functional changes after 300 wipes on the keyboard. If you go to the following slide, you'll see some of the germicides that were used. We used a number of germicides, things such as phenolics, quaternary ammonium compounds, alcohol, chlorine, all commonly used germicides. We essentially applied that germicide to see if it was effective in the removing microorganisms that were inoculated. And if you go to a slide that's entitled Disinfection of Computer Keyboards, you will see that all the tested products were effective in removing and or inactivating the test pathogens. Now, we use test pathogens such as MRSA, VRE, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and again, all the tested products, to include the three quaternary ammonium compounds, a 70% isopropyl alcohol, a phenolic, and chlorine at a concentration of 80 parts per million, all of them were effective in removing or inactivating the test pathogens. I should also mention that we have a recommendation here at UNC Healthcare that we recommend the keyboards be disinfected daily, and it only requires a 5-second wipe and when visibly soiled. The other thing that I want to mention quickly, which is shown on the following slide, is that quaternary ammonium compounds seem to have sustained antimicrobial effectiveness. The way this experiment was done is we would put the various disinfectants that you see on the left column, the alcohol, the quaternary ammonium compound, which is what is in Cavil wipe, the Clorox disinfecting wipe, that's a quaternary ammonium compound, the Santa Cloth Plus, that's a quaternary ammonium compound, and sterile water. We would put those products on the keyboard, and then we would challenge at 6 hours, challenge at 24 hours, and challenge at 48 hours, and then we would monitor the efficacy of the disinfectant by time of microbial challenge and the duration of disinfectant exposure. And the bottom line, without going into too much detail, is that the quats had a sustained antimicrobial effectiveness. They continued to kill the test organism, and in this case, it's a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. They continued to kill the test organism not only at 6 hours, but also 24 and 48 hours. So it had sustained antimicrobial effectiveness. And that's what is concluded in the following slide, which talks about quats demonstrated excellent sustained activity against VRE, and antimicrobial activity was maintained over the 48-hour test period. The next slide should talk about touchscreen cleaning. The touchscreen cleaning, the issue here is we wanted to see how to clean our touchscreens. So one of my colleagues actually evaluated the manufacturer's recommendations, and they found that different manufacturers recommended different cleaning solutions. Cleaning solutions, which are shown in the second bullet, such as alcohol, glutaraldehyde, mild soap, and phenolics. Generally, quats were not recommended by some manufacturers. So what we have done is essentially we have chosen one of those products. In our case, it was alcohol. And we have followed the manufacturer's recommendation for cleaning those touchscreens in our hospital. So that's the point. Follow the manufacturer's recommendation. We have found that alcohol has worked so far. We wet a clean, soft cloth with a selected cleaning solution. We remove the excess liquid from the cloth and squeeze until it's damp. And then, of course, we wipe the exposed surfaces and remove any soap residue by gently wiping with a clean cloth. So that's essentially what we're doing with touchscreens. As we can see, we've done nearly everything, but we haven't talked about MRSA. So the last thing we're going to do is talk about MRSA. I'm going to ask you to turn to a slide that's entitled at the top MRSA, and it has a few comments to include the fact that MRSA is, of course, present in the environment of patients that are colonized or infected with MRSA. That is, if you sample patients' room that are colonized or infected with MRSA, you'll see, or you will be able to recover MRSA at a frequency of anywhere from 20% to 50% to as much as 74%. So MRSA, like norovirus, like C. difficile spores, can remain in the environment for days to week. And, of course, we have seen, as shown by the fourth bullet, that cleaning or disinfecting the environment can reduce transmission, but cleaning regimens as currently practiced may not eliminate MRSA from surfaces. Now, why is that? Why have we not been able to eliminate MRSA from surfaces? Well, if we go to, skip the next slide and go to a slide that's entitled Practice or Product. Is it our practices or is it the products that we use are ineffective against MRSA? Now, go to the next slide. I think in the next several slides, we're going to see data which demonstrate that our products are very effective against MRSA. There's no difference in essentially inactivating MRSA, that is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, than inactivating methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus. So that's shown in the slide that's entitled Susceptibility of MSSA and MRSA to a phenolic and a quaternary ammonium compound. And then in another slide that shows essentially the says Table 2 disinfectant activity against antibiotic susceptible and antibiotic resistant bacteria. If you look at the far right side of that slide, you'll see MRSA, and you'll see that you get as much as greater than 4.6 log reduction with products such as Fesfine, which is a phenolic, Clorox, which of course is a chlorine-containing product, and then we see the Lysol disinfectant and the Lysol antibacterial. Very quick inactivation of MRSA, 0.5 minutes or 30 seconds. Well, if it's not product, is it practice? Well, let's go to another slide that talks about surface disinfectants and effectiveness of different methods. In a study that we recently completed, we looked at every imaginable method for cleaning surfaces. We looked at a saturated cloth. We looked at a method involving spraying, letting it sit for 10 seconds, and wiping. Spraying, wiping, spraying, let it sit for a minute, then wiping. Spraying and not wiping. And then spray, wipe, spray until dry. And all of those methods were extremely effective in removing or inactivating MRSA from surfaces. So it's not the technique that we're using that is causing our problem. The next slide will really answer the question why we're able to isolate MRSA from patients' rooms that have been just disinfected with a product that is known to be effective. And essentially what I'm referring to is a paper that is written by Carling and colleagues that was published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology in 2008, January 2008. And what this slide showed, and what the study showed was that if you went to 23 hospitals and involved 23 hospitals in the study, evaluated over 1,100 rooms, over 13,000 objects, you'll find that the mean proportion of objects cleaned was 49%. So 51% of the objects in a terminally clean room were never cleaned. So they were never cleaned. 51% of the objects, these are high-touch objects in a patient's room, were never cleaned. So obviously there's substantial opportunity for improving not only daily cleaning, but in this case, terminal cleaning and disinfecting activities. So it's really the practice, not the product. The practice, because the surfaces are not being wiped. These products worked, but the practices involve a procedure that does not involve wiping in all cases. The only other thing that I wanted to mention is, of course, as we've already mentioned, the hydrogen peroxide vapor has also been shown to be effective in, of course, eliminating C. difficile spores from surfaces. So, in summary, what we've said in the last hour and 10 minutes is disinfection and sterilization guidelines must be followed to prevent exposure to pathogens that can lead to infection. We've talked about endoscopes and semi-critical items represent the greatest risk. We've talked about automated endoscope reprocessors and new high-level disinfectants. We've also mentioned the class 6 indicators are not a substitute for biological indicators. We've talked about clusters involving C. difficile and norovirus, and when we have clusters, it may be prudent to use a product that is shown to be effective, and one product is sodium hypochlorite at a concentration of 1 to 10 dilution of bleach. We've talked about microfibers, and microfibers demonstrating superior microbial removal compared to a cotton string mop with a detergent. And we've also talked about disinfectants demonstrating excellent activity against MRSA, but that our practices are deficient, and we need to employ improved practices to improve the removal and inactivation of epidemiologically important microorganisms from surfaces. We've also mentioned, of course, the fact that quats have sustained antimicrobial activity. So if you look at the next slide, those are the current issues and the new technology. The current issues, I think there's 21 of them, involving critical, semi-critical, non-critical items, the things that I think are timely, new technologies, issues that have been commonly asked, and hopefully try to provide some answer. Thank you for being part of the seminar this afternoon, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to meet in person sometime in the future. Thank you very much.
Bill, thank you very much. And thank you as well for that website that's mentioned there, disinfectionandsterilization.org. I've had the occasion to use that several times, and there's a real wealth of information there. I hope everyone who's listening will access it. It's very good. Just a quick disclaimer before we close. There were a number of product names and brands mentioned. And as always, the Teleclass Education Program and Weber Training do not endorse or advertise any particular product, and mention of those names should not be considered as such. So thank you again to all. Bill, a special thank you to you, and I hope that we'll be able to talk again very soon. Goodbye.